B-Pod Studios.
Live from Gillette Stadium, it's New England Patriots Training Camp 2022, presented by Safety Insurance. Also brought to you by United Construction and Win Waste Innovations on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
Back here, 98.5 The Sports Hub. It is Gasper Murray, Tim McCone in for Big Jim. We are live at Patriots Training Camp, and this hour of training camp is brought to you by United Construction, and we are joined now by NBC Sports Boston's Phil Perry, who's been out here every day for training camp.
Oh, yeah.
Every day? Love it.
All four.
Love it. Grinding away. So what's been the big takeaway for you so far over the first few days of camp?
Well, I just can't get the end of this past practice out of my mind, guys, because it was ugly. It was really ugly for the offense. And we sat here and said after day one of practice, I guess the overall takeaway would be that it's been a bit of a roller coaster for both sides. Because after day one, if you were here, all you could see was Mac Jones and Kendrick Bourne and Hunter Henry and these guys just whooping it up consistently across the practice because they had a good day.
Yeah.
So good for them. And then the end of the practice on Thursday, day two, did not go as well. And they could not complete a pass on 10 straight snaps. And they were able to complete one on the final one, which won them the day, which the defense wasn't thrilled about. They ended up having to do push-ups. They go 1-for-11, and they win the drill. Doesn't make a lot of sense. But that was sort of their down day. I thought they rebounded yesterday. I thought today was ugly at the end for the offense. There was a lot of, I just said this to Tom Curran, and he just politely on Twitter pointed out this one comment that I'm sure will get people stirring. I said, they had a few reps out there that were a little reminiscent of the Tim Tebow era, Tom.
Oh, love that.
Ooh. Meaning,
love that.
Not that Mac Jones or even Bailey Zappi is Tim Tebow. Believe me, I don't feel that way. But get the snap, pat it, pat it, pat it. Nobody's open. Run around and scramble. When it's very obvious, really, the issue, probably if we were able to have the film here and watch it all back, we'd look at it and say, these receivers just can't get open. And so what's your reaction to that if I tell you Devontae Parker and Nelson Agholor and Kendrick Bourne and Jacoby Myers, even because this is the first team offense, is having trouble separating against the defense that the Patriots have right now? Because I don't think anybody thinks that highly of this defense, but they were sticky today in coverage, Chris.
That is a little alarming if you're looking at it that way. I mean, on the other hand, I'd look at it, and it's not really the other hand, but I just think the guys they brought in are not huge separation guys, right? Like,
true,
we knew that about Devontae Parker. We knew he's not a huge separation guy. You know, Jacoby Myers finds a way to get open, but he's not going to blow past people. Agholor, for the money they paid him, you think would be a separation guy, but we didn't see it last year. So let me ask you this, Phil. Do you feel like not getting a ton of separation is sort of like baked into what the offensive plan is for Patricia and Bill Belichick, or do you think, you know, they're sort of concerned and feel like, we need more separation to make this easier for our quarterback?
Well, what's interesting is it didn't seem like an issue when they were very red zone focused through 3 days of practice. And you saw a little bit more of that even today. But they did almost exclusively red zone work the first 3 days of practice, where separation is hard to come by anyway, right? Even if you are Wes Welker, you know, name your quick guy of choice. So it wasn't an issue when Devontae Parker's winning 50-50 balls, which he did, or Hunter Henry or Jonnu Smith are making contested catches. It's today when it looked like in the first 11-on-11 period, they're just starting in the middle of the field and trying to move the ball. And they were able to complete a few passes, but the completions, again, were on scramble drills, so somebody's not open initially, or there's pressure getting to the quarterback initially that's essentially ruining the play for the offense. You'd probably chalk it up as an L for the offense, and I thought that happened on 7 or 8 consecutive plays.
Wow.
I have the first team offense, so the Mac Jones-led offense, as 5-for-11 in the last two 11-for-11 11-on-11 periods, which sounds bad, right? It was even worse because some of those five completions were on these plays that I'm talking about, which is not what the play was designed to do. One was an offensive pass interference from Jacoby Myers down in the corner of the end zone. I thought it looked like a little bit of a push-off on Sean Wade. It ended up being a pretty nice catch, but I thought he pushed off. And then he throws a pick for a pick six at the very early in practice, which was, again, he's scrambling around, stopping, throwing back across the grain. So do you put it on Mac Jones? Sure, of course. He's the one with the ball in his hands. But it just looked like the way these plays were drawn up, they just couldn't execute almost a single one at the end of practice here.
Can we go class F, Phil? Can you tell me that the defense is going to be like the 2000 Ravens, maybe, and that's why the offense
is struggling
so much? Is there anyone offensively that's kind of stood out to you that you might be feeling a little bit optimistic about, whether it's Jonnu Smith maybe taking a jump here in the second year, or a guy like Trey Nixon who felt like he had some buzz coming into the first few days?
Yeah, I would say the best rep that they had offensively today was to Hunter Henry, and no surprise there, in the red zone.
Yeah.
Right? He's had a very consistent, I would say, training camp through four practices. I thought Jonnu Smith was one of their best players on the field yesterday, and one of my quote-unquote bold predictions on NBCSportsBoston.com before camp was that Jonnu Smith would be the star of camp, and I only believed that because I knew they were going to try to hammer him with targets and really incorporate him into this offense, and I think there's going to be a scheme change that we'll be able to maybe identify a little bit better next week when the pads come on and you start to see the run game and how the pass game works off of that. I think that will benefit Jonnu Smith as well. So those two guys have stood out to me. Devontae Parker has stood out to me, not so much today, but through the first 3 days, as probably their best receiver. And then defensively, Jalen Mills is somebody that to me has consistently been good all 4 days. And so if you're looking at who are going to be these two outside starting corners, I think you have somebody who is capable. And Jalen Mills, is he a one? No, I don't think I would go that far yet, but he's had a very good 4 days. And then the question is, who's on the opposite side of him? It's been Terrence Mitchell all 4 days, which I found interesting. I thought they would rotate some guys. I thought Malcolm Butler would get a lot of work with that first group. It's been Mitchell all the way through. Butler's been solidly with the second group opposite Jack Jones, the rookie fourth-round pick.
I want to hit you with two questions here, but I have my real question, but I just want to piggyback off what you just said about the cornerbacks. Is there any chance here that Malcolm Butler doesn't make this team? Like, I think we're all sort of assuming he's, like, on the team, but they drafted two rookie corners, obviously. You mentioned Terrence Mitchell being there. Sean Wade's still on the roster. Is there any chance he doesn't make this team, or is it just that because they have so many of these guys that sort of profile more as inside corners, as stars, and Malcolm can play the outside, that he'll be on the team?
I would think that he's on the team just because you want a little bit of depth there, not knowing what you have in some of these others. But let's go to the contract. The contract is less than $1 million guaranteed, and so when you're in that range, to me, I kind of usually set it at about $1 million. If you're making $1 million guaranteed, you're going to be on the roster. If you're not, you don't know. I think he's still going to be here because he's $750,000 guaranteed, but not only because of that, but again, because of the experience factor.
Sure.
And I think they felt like when they last saw him, now, again, they're getting a chance to actually see him in the modern day version of Malcolm Butler. But when they last saw him 2 years ago, what I was told was they really believed like he still had plenty of juice physically left. So that's 2 years ago with the Titans now, but they felt optimistic about his ability to contribute.
It's just kind of weird that he wouldn't be beating. Maybe they just want to get more of a look at Terrence Mitchell, but I would think he should be beating out Mitchell and Mills.
Or at least sharing those reps, right?
Yeah, and maybe it's just they want to get a look at Mitchell and a better look at Mills. Okay, my real question, because you commented on this on Twitter yesterday, and as did I, the reports out of Pittsburgh are glowing so far on George Pickens, who was taken number 52, two picks after Tyquan Thornton. So I just want to ask you, because I haven't been here that much, this is only my second day, what have you seen from Tyquan Thornton? And you mentioned separation. That's why they drafted this guy. That's why they moved up four picks in the second round, because he's supposed to be able to separate like guys, on their roster can't.
I thought we would see, when they were working in the middle of the field today, I thought we would see a deep ball or two to the rookie who runs the 4-2. Because in the red zone, that's just, to me, that's not where he's going to shine. Unless he becomes this contested catch maven, that's not his game. He's a down-the-field guy who needs space to let that speed build and run by people and threaten safeties. When everything's condensed in the red zone the way it's been, we've seen him contribute, but it's been pretty consistently with the second team. He's worked a little bit with Mac Jones in some of the 7-on-7 periods, and he has made a handful of pretty nice catches in some tight quarters. We've seen him make a couple sliding catches near the boundary. So it hasn't been like he's been invisible, but we just haven't seen him do what he's been brought here to do yet. I think that stuff is coming later. They were so red zone focused for 3 days. I don't think they got to do enough of it in the spring, they felt, so they hammered it early. The pads come on in a couple days. Maybe we'll see some play action shots to him when they start to work on the pass game and how it really complements the running game the next few days.
And just quickly, are you seeing the full route tree from him, or is it too early to tell?
To me, it's too early to tell. I mean, again, when you're in the red zone, you're talking quick outs, you're talking slants, you know. What we haven't really seen, Chris, from him, and I'd have to go back through my notes and check, Devontae Parker gets a half dozen balls thrown to him in the back corner of the end zone, the 50-50 lob, right? Hunter Henry, Jonnu Smith, those guys are all that kind of option. Tyquan Thornton's not a short guy. He's obviously a very skinny guy, but he's 6'2", and he's a pretty good athlete. You would think maybe they would try that stuff with him. I don't remember seeing that, though.
What side of the ball did you have the most question marks coming into camp with, and what are you going to have your eyes on here in the next couple of days when the pads actually do come on?
In terms of the rosters, the defense, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, the coaching staff is one thing offensively, and we all have questions as to how that's going to work. But defensively, to me, you have questions at corner. You have questions on the edge, which I think have gone completely under the radar here for some reason. I don't know why. It's only one of the most valuable positions in the sport, and they have one clear starter there. In my opinion, I think a lot of people think Josh Uche is going to be an impactful player there. I don't know that.
Right.
He played 240 snaps last year. I don't know if anybody would remember a single one. So, you know, that guy's in his third year, and he's a great athlete, but we just haven't seen it. And with Dietrich Wise actually missing the last several practices, the guy who's seen a lot of early reps on the opposite edge, and I think we may see a scheme change defensively too, the guy who's been getting a lot of time on the opposite edge has been Henry Anderson. So you think of him as a defensive tackle, yeah. Maybe a little bit slimmer as a pass-rushing defensive tackle. I think, you know, this defense, really since Flores left, and you never see the base front seven anymore, I understand that.
Yeah.
But defenses are either constructed as a 3-4 defense or a 4-3 defense, and there are differences between the two. 4-3, you have true defensive ends. 3-4, you have outside linebackers. Pittsburgh's a great example of 3-4 defense. Smaller guys, true outside linebackers on the edge. To me, what we've seen has been more of a four-down front. So Matt Judon is still there. I think he's big enough he could be a defensive end or an outside linebacker. But then it was Henry Anderson getting a lot of early work in where I would suspect Dietrich Wise would be. Now, Uche gets some early reps too, especially in sub situations, and they've always been a versatile defense. They'll tell you that. But I think they're willing to be bigger on the edge, on the outside, because if I'm them, I don't trust Josh Uche on first and second down.
No.
To me, he's not a starter. He's a pass rush specialist. So Henry Anderson and Dietrich Wise, whoever is here and on the field and available, I think those guys could end up being the guy, but is that what you want? You know, I just look at this defense and I say there's too many critical spots that I have questions about. Safety, great. But linebacker, outside, edge, whatever you want to call it, and corner are three spots where I don't know who's going to be playing week one. That I don't think there's any question to me personnel-wise where you'd have more questions.
Quickly, your thoughts on the Devon Godshall extension?
Best defensive lineman in the league, or one of them. One of the best. One of the best defensive linemen in the league. I mean, you know, shrug your shoulders at that. It just guarantees, for me, it guarantees that he'll be here for the next couple of years, and he'll have a prominent role for the next couple of years. I also just find it interesting, because their run defense was not good last year, right? By really any measure.
No.
It's very clear to me where Bill Belichick saw the problem. It's at the linebacker level, because the whole interior defensive line is still here.
Yeah.
Christian Barmore, Devon Godshaw, Lawrence Guy.
Great point.
Carl Davis is back. No issue there, I guess. I guess that's how I would read it. You know, Juwan Bentley's back to play linebacker, I think, to give them a little bit of continuity. But we've seen a ton of Raekwon McMillan. We've seen a ton of Mack Wilson. Dante Hightower, obviously, not back. Kyle Van Noy told, we don't need you anymore. So that is maybe the most interesting angle to this is Bill saw a problem not at the first level but at the second level of his defense last year because he's now bringing all the first-level guys back, and now he's throwing the money on top of it. So that area of your team better be improved. It's not as important as these guys make it out to be. It's still a pass-first league, and you've got to be better there, and that's where I would be giving my money to. I'd be saving money for Christian Barmore, honestly, is what I would be doing if I'm Bill Belichick.
Yeah.
But they have to be better in that phase, and it looks like Bill Belichick's putting it all in the linebackers.
All right, he is Phil Perry of NBC Sports Boston. Phil, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Anytime, guys. Good to see you.
All right, Gaspar and Murray continues next. Your phone call is after.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This.
Live at Gillette Stadium for Training Camp 2022, presented by Safety Insurance on Boston's home for New England Patriots football, 98.5 The Sports Hub.
All right, back here at 98.5, the Sports Hub. It is Gaspar and Murray. Tim McCone in for Big Jim on this Saturday. We are live at Patriots training camp, and we are joined now by Mark Daniels of the Providence Journal. Mark, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It's nice and cool up here in the shade.
Yeah, I like it. Right? This, yeah. This is the spot. This is the spot to be, no question.
I was sweating down there today.
Really?
So first question, what's been your big takeaway over the first few days here of training camp?
It's been the defense. They've won practice the last 3 days in a row. Honestly, since the offense started throwing beyond the 10-yard line, things just have been stale for them. A bit worrisome for me, honestly. This is non-padded practices. It's built for the receivers to get separation on cornerbacks who can't touch them and catch the ball, but that really hasn't been the case. I mean, today, I had Mac Jones 6 of 12 and 11 on 11s, and put that in perspective, minicamp, he was over 90%.
Oh,
like,
wow.
He was on fire in minicamp. I came in training camp, so like, all right, they've got a Pro Bowl quarterback, and things are rolling for the offense,
yeah.
But that really hasn't been the case this week so far.
When you look at the offense, I think one of the biggest questions really is just sort of how it's going to work with the play calling. What have you seen so far in terms of that, and how involved at the end of the day do you think Bill Belichick will be offensively with the play calling? I mean, are we looking at sort of a, you know, Sean McVay, Andy Reid type of situation where he's there with the play sheet the whole game?
Yeah, I think ultimately this is Bill Belichick's offense now. And you talk to the players, these meetings are being run by three different people, three different voices. It's Belichick, Matt Patricia, and Joe Judge. That's strange to hear, but with the playbook itself, the terminology is completely different. And I asked Jacoby Myers about this yesterday, and he said it's actually been difficult for him because the first 3 years he knows the play calls, he knows the playbook, he comes into year four, and it's different. And they did this to try to simplify it, and their sort of theory here is, all right, we'll make it easier on the coaches and easier on the players to sort of just dumb things down. Now, it's the plays themselves, essentially the same. There's no fullback out there, but they're trying to sort of make things easier on everyone to make the offense easier to learn. Because historically under Josh McDaniels, it was a very tough system to sort of grasp for newcomers.
Is this, when you mentioned the terminology, because we had Ramondre Stevenson on, and that's what he said, you know, simplified terminology, they've done that. Are they trying to move this to more like a McVay-Shanahan type of terminology? Like, whose terminology is this? Because for years it was sort of the old Ron Earhart offense, and they had this offense that they had taken for years and years and years. So it's interesting to hear the terminology has changed. I mean, have they just cut play calls down, or is this actually like a different offensive terminology from a different system?
I've been asking the players exactly that, and the questions I'm getting are sort of all over the place. Guys who just won't talk to me about it. But basically the way it's been described to me is that it's easier to remember. The play calls are sort of make sense. And I keep asking, I'm like, all right, what does this mean exactly?
Yeah.
You keep saying it's simpler.
Yeah.
How? Is it one word? You know? I know, like, with Josh McDaniels, they would have play calls and essentially receivers' routes, and it would change depending on the coverage. So you have one play call, a guy could run three or four different routes. I just wonder if, I don't know. Honestly, it's something I have to keep asking these guys because I'm not getting the right answers right now. I mean, I asked Damian Harris yesterday. He didn't answer the question at all. So,
Can you give us a couple guys that have kind of stood out to you so far in these first few days of camp?
Yeah, absolutely. Joshua Bledsoe has been one of the early standouts. He had, I want to say, four pass breakups the first 2 days. I think that's a great sign for the Patriots. I mean, is Devin McCourty here next year? He might retire like his brother did, you know, this past off season. So you need a young free safety behind him, and I think Joshua has definitely made the most out of his opportunities. I keep seeing Trey Nixon pop a little bit. He made a really great catch yesterday in contested coverage, but also on the punt returning. That's a big deal right now because they lost Gunnar Olszewski, so who's the guy? They drafted Marcus Jones, so obviously he's in play, but Trey Nixon looks like he's the next guy up with punt returning, so he could be one of those under-the-radar guys to stick, but he needs special teams to do it.
You will. We have to give some credit, obviously, to the defense based on what they've done the last couple of days. So I want to ask you, what have you seen at linebacker? Because there's a little bit of a shakeup there. I mean, Raekwon McMillan looked great last year in camp until he tore the ACL. Cameron McGrone sort of had the red shirt year coming off the torn ACL. At Michigan, they trade for Mack Wilson. Is that an upgraded group? And who do you think are the main guys there at linebacker at the end of the day?
I mean, by name, it's not an upgraded group, but I do wonder if we just see more zone defense. So they've looked for guys who are sort of smaller and more athletic. But right now, for the main inside linebackers, it's been Raekwon McMillan and Jawan Bentley. And then Mack Wilson has sort of been the third guy there. But off the ball, it's obviously Matt Judon and Josh Uche. But I'll tell you what, today, one guy who really popped for me was Anfernee Jennings. I'll be honest, I thought it was...
First time I've heard that name in like two years.
I forgot he was on the team.
So I thought it was the best practice I've seen from him in the last 3 years. He had three plays in a row that he blew up the offense. So one, he sacks Bailey Zappe. And the next play coming off the edge moves Zappe out of the pocket, who throws the ball away. So then Mac Jones and the starters come in. He does the same thing. He got in the backfield, made Mac roll out, and sort of messed that play up again. I was like, I kept looking at my roster. I'm like, 58? Who's 58? I'm like, oh, it's Anthony Jennings. So I thought that was really impressive.
All right, so we really get going in a couple of days here when the pads come on. So what are the biggest questions you kind of have for this roster going into Monday?
I need to see something from the offensive line and defensive line because so far there's been just no contact. I want to see how Cole Strange looks in that starting unit and, you know, how do these defensive tackles look? But really, I think the offensive line, there's been such a shakeup in the middle with Owenu at guard, Strange at guard, and they flipped Isaiah Wynn and Trent Brown, but honestly, there's been nothing to really analyze there because they haven't been able to touch anyone. Even with the running backs, like we don't know. Like Ramondre Stevenson, it looks like he has better hands and better receiving, but is he faster? I mean, I'd like to see Pierre Strong out there and guys like that, but then you go to like the cornerbacks and the guys we're talking about on the receivers, they haven't been jammed yet. Like we haven't seen any one-on-one drills between cornerbacks and receivers, and when the pads come on, that's sort of when the guys really start to stick out. I tell this story all the time. In 2014, like OTAs and minicamp, it was this undrafted corner, Dak Swanson, who stuck out. But then pads came on, and it was all Malcolm Butler. Like, everything changed for Malcolm Butler when pads came on. So, yeah, Joshua Bledsoe's look good. Trey Nixon's look good. Will they look good when pads come on? That's the ultimate test, and really when the real competition starts.
What have you seen from this cornerback group, particularly the two young guys that they drafted? Marcus Jones, you mentioned, in punt return, but he was drafted in the third round. And also Jack Jones, a fourth-round pick. What have you seen from those two young corners first, and then that group overall who stood out to you?
Yeah, Jack Jones has a real possibility to play major defensive snaps. I really like his swagger. He's super confident. I asked him today, I'm like, you're going up against NFL receivers every day. Does it build your confidence? He's like, no, I'm always confident. I'm like, all right, you need that swagger to play that position. But he's shown up a ton in minicamp and a little bit this week. And Marcus Jones, this is the first time we've seen him because he was injured or rehabbing his shoulder injuries all offseason. I mean, he has a chance to be the top backup slot cornerback behind Jonathan Jones, and I'm really looking forward to seeing him in the preseason with the return game. He was electric in college, but right now I'd say the top two cornerbacks are Jalen Mills and Terrence Mitchell. It's been that way all week. It puts, I'd say, Malcolm Butler in an interesting position where they sign him. You're like, all right, theoretically Malcolm could start, but theoretically Malcolm could be a surprise cut, right? He didn't play last year. I think he's clearly behind Mills and Mitchell, and he's been really playing mainly opposite of Jones.
What about my guy Sean Wade, who I like was stumping for all last year? Is he? I mean, that was the thing with Sean Wade in college, right? He plays in the slot at Ohio State. He's great. Everybody thinks he's going to be a first round pick. They move him outside his last year there. It doesn't really go well. He gets drafted in the fifth or sixth round or whatever.
Yeah.
So is he strictly an inside guy for the Patriots, or are they trying him outside? Where does he fit in?
Yeah. So right now, mainly inside. He's actually been getting a ton of reps with Jonathan Jones out. He's really playing over Marcus Jones. It's been interesting. They had this two tight end set on, so they have a core interior wise that they like. I didn't love the Pats rush defense last year. I thought a lot had to improve. So, but hey, they've picked their guys and they're sticking to it.
Let me ask you about this one guy, because I think he needs to have a big season for Mac Jones to have a big season, and I think Mac Jones needs to have a big season for the Patriots to have a big season. What have you seen so far from Kendrick Bourne?
Kendrick Bourne has been sort of, I'd say, hit or miss for me. There are plays you look at him, you say, yeah, Kendrick could be a 900th, a 1,000-yard guy in the NFL. But I would say there's been a couple snaps over the past couple days. He just hasn't been able to hang on to the ball. And it's like not obvious drops, but I'm talking about, all right, you have to sort of dive. You have to lay out. You want your number one, number two, you know, 1,000-yard receiver to catch those passes. Just, it hasn't been consistent on him. He hasn't made the difficult catches routinely.
All right, he's Mark Daniels of the Providence Journal. Mark, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me out here.
All right, more Gasper Murray coming up after this. Plus, I promise we will get to your phone calls next here on 98.5 The Sports.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
No one gets you into training camp like we do. Live from Gillette Stadium, it's New England Patriots Training Camp 2022. Presented by Safety Insurance on Boston's home for New England Patriots football. 98.5 The Sports Hub.
All right, back here at 98.5 The Sports Hub. It is Gasper and Murray, Tim McCone in for Big Jim on this Saturday, taking you up until 2 o'clock. We are live at Patriots Training Camp, and this hour of training camp is brought to you by United Construction. I've been talking Patriots for most of the afternoon here, Chris, but we touched on the Kevin Durant situation regarding Boston a little bit earlier, and I want to just circle back to that, too, because Zach Lowe over at ESPN dropped again. What winds up, if you have a 6 hours today free, you can read it. You can get caught up with it. But it kind of pretty much lays out the situation and the kind of the two camps that people fall in, whether or not they want, you know, to pull the trigger on a deal to bring in Kevin Durant for a guy like Jaylen Brown. I thought it was interesting, too, because he mentioned this on his podcast earlier in the week as well. You know, just kind of informally talking to guys across the league. He said 2/3 of the league said, yes, absolutely, you make that deal. You bring in Kevin Durant. And he said another third of the league thinks that if you do that and you make that move, man, you are potentially blowing up a lot in terms of what you've built here in Boston over the last few years. And you don't necessarily give up on a young core that just got you within two wins of an NBA championship. So I found that pretty interesting. But when it comes to Jaylen Brown, you said you would not move him. I think that's the way to look at it, though, too. Regardless of the other pieces that would be involved in this trade and the amount of picks that you would be throwing at it, to me it really comes down to, do you want to build around Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, or are you willing to break up that young core and move forward with a 2 to 3 year window of prime Kevin Durant with Jason Tatum and hope that you cash in on that, you know, that time frame with an NBA championship?
No, I agree with you, and I think that really is the major debate here, which is why when I read, you know, both Kevin O'Connor and Zach Lowe recently have had pieces where they seem to indicate, whether it's their own opinion or it's something that they're getting from their Celtics sources, that there's a real consternation on the part of the Celtics about having to give up Marcus Smart in this deal. Like, that could be the deal breaker for Kevin Durant. It's like, yeah, we'll give you Jaylen Brown and we'll give you Derek White and we'll give you all these picks. Smart? Oh, no. Can't do that. Can't give up Marcus Smart to get Kevin Durant. That's mind-blowing to me. And there's a passage in this piece where Lowe, again, either he's parroting what he's hearing from the Celtics or this is his genuine sort of opinion, where he's basically saying, you know, Smart is too valuable to give up in this deal for Durant. He says Smart is more to Boston than a good player. He's a keystone in its structural identity. Brogdon and White are good defenders, but they can't do what Smart does. You almost have to reimagine the team's very constitution with a regular point guard in Smart's place. That's right. Trading Brown, Smart, and picks for Durant makes Boston bigger, older, and thinner. It probably improves their title odds this season, but not enough, here at least, to justify the hit to Boston's medium and long-term future. Durant should also want Smart on the Celtics if he ends up there. So I threw up my breakfast when I read this, to be honest. I'm like, I mean, do you ever see that Twilight Zone episode It's a famous one where basically it's a different world where everybody has the pig noses.
Yes.
I forget who it is, Janet Lee or whoever, who's absolutely gorgeous. And they're like, but you're ugly because you don't have the pig. That's what I feel like I deal with on a daily basis with Marcus Smart. I feel like I'm in the twilight zone. Like, what am I missing? This guy's a good player. He's a valuable role player. No question about it. But in terms of this untouchable, untradeable, unmovable piece, what am I missing? And also, if he is all this stuff that people like KOC and Lowe and the Celtics are putting out there, then explain to me another guy who's been that valuable in the history of the league where his team has gone out and spent two first-round picks on another point guard and then made another deal where they bring in a $20 million player at his position.
Right. I mean, the evaluation there based on what the front office has done and what Brad Stevens has done would tell you that they don't value Marcus Smart as much as what Zach Lowe just laid out there in that article. Otherwise, you don't bring in and spend the resources they have on a guy like Derek White or bringing in Malcolm Brogdon this offseason as well. I couldn't believe you sent that over early this morning. I couldn't believe reading part of that, too, because I'm with you. Look, I'm a Marcus Smart guy. I think he does have some value.
He does. But, I don't dispute that.
But if you think that if you want to bring in Kevin Durant, and that's the hang-up, you're not going to pull the trigger on that deal because of Marcus Smart, then, I mean, you being in charge of an NBA organization needs to be reevaluated. To me, it doesn't make any sense at all. If you're willing to move on from Jaylen Brown, and I think that's really what this thing comes down to, like, if you're willing to part with that, then you make this move, regardless, I think, of who else is in the deal. Outside of one player, which I thought was interesting, too, and Zach Lowe's brought up, Robert Williams. I'm not sure why the Nets' asking price wouldn't involve him. I don't know if it's just a hard no that they wouldn't want him involved in that deal. That's fair, too. But, like, to me, I would rather have a Robert Williams over a guy like a Marcus Smart. But, yeah, no, Marcus Smart is not something that would hang. Like, if you don't want to do this deal, it's because you don't want to give up Jaylen Brown. It has nothing to do with Marcus Smart. To me, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't understand that part of it. Again, I mean, I think you said it really well and succinctly. I mean, again, if you're willing to go as far as breaking up your main core with Jaylen Brown, then why would you not move Smart? And I'll frame it this way. Part of bringing in Derek White was to have the flexibility that if you were in a position to get something back that was really valuable and it cost you Smart, that you could do it and be okay.
Yep.
You know, I'm not saying White is as good as Smart, although Ime Udoka has said repeatedly, and he said in the playoffs, that there was not much of a drop-off. Those are his words, not mine. That's the head coach's words, not mine, saying not much of a drop-off. But that was part of it, was getting that flexibility to be able to move him. Also, around the trade deadline, they were considering moving Marcus Smart in a deal for Kevin Huerter. So now you're not going to throw him in as like a throw-in to get Kevin Durant? Like, okay, we'll trade you Marcus Smart if we can get this Kevin, but not this Kevin.
Right.
That doesn't even make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
and it's not like Smart was like great in the finals. Even after the finals, although they were unwilling to point the finger at him, and I had the advanced stats in the story I wrote. I mean, he was one of their lowest-rated offensive players in the fourth quarter of the finals. And he had, I think, 3.2 turnovers per game to Jaylen Brown's 3.3. So that's not great, obviously. We're bagging on Jaylen Brown, rightfully so, for the turnovers. But your point guard was right there with him, essentially. And obviously in game one, when they had the great fourth quarter, he wasn't really on the court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he came and hit the two threes late, but he wasn't even on the court. But what Brad Stevens said in the press conference, sort of the post-mortem, was we needed more playmaking. And so what Zach Lowe saying here is that he's their best passer, and I do agree with that, but still they needed more offensive creation and playmaking on top of Smart. And if that's what you needed to bring in, then you should be willing to sort of part with the player. And I also think, McCone, that Marcus Smart's a very deserving defensive player of the year, but I do feel like defensively people are giving him too much credit for that defense, because I feel like what he did this year, he's done in the past. The real difference in the defense was that the bigs could switch on anybody.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, too, because you go back to last year, not this past season, but the one before that, so 2 years ago. Defensively, it felt like he took a step back, right? And this year, he kind of had a bit of a resurgence.
Yeah, he was great.
On that end. So, no, you don't want to take anything away from him. Look, nobody nerds out on NBA offseason more than me. I was lucky enough to be on draft night. I'm doing, like, mock drafts with the 53rd pick that Celtics are. And irrelevant, by the way. Like, after pick 10, nobody really matters in the
like
NBA
JD
draft.
Davison. They might have something there.
Here's my thing. Like, ultimately, all that stuff and all the time I waste looking at that stuff, it's a superstar league, man. Like, don't overthink it. And so if you're talking about, you know, big pieces being moved, it really comes down to Are you willing to move on from Jaylen Brown for Kevin Durant? And Marcus Smart, nice player, definition of replaceable to me. Honestly,
no, I agree.
Like he's a starter in the NBA. That's it. You can ultimately find guys like that, like a Derek White, by the way, which I think is a comparable player. And I just if that's the hang up, no, it makes zero sense.
I totally agree with you on that. If that is the hang up, it doesn't make any sense. And I would say a couple things as well. Smart's trade value probably will never be higher.
No,
right? His trade value is very high coming off the season. And also, I would feel differently about this from a Celtics standpoint if I didn't already have Derek White and Malcolm Brogdon. But I have two starter-caliber point guards behind him. I have
the flexibility,
at that position. I might not want to give up Marcus Smart, and I understand not wanting to give him up, but I can survive it because I have these two other guys here, and that's kind of the whole point.
All right, 617-779-0985. Let's sneak in a couple calls here. Let's go talk to Rob in Middleton. Rob, what's going on?
Well, thank you for taking my phone call. And, Tim, I think you've hit something really important here. And you talked about the Celtics' failure in the fourth quarter this year. And I think that the problem is the system. I've never seen a basketball, a championship team where you have two great players and they're on opposite sides of the offensive floor. So bringing in Durant, I would hope that Tatum and Durant could play a little two ball at the end of the game. The Celtics struggled at the end of the game, and I think they'd never play two ball. And when I mean Pippen and Jordan and blah, blah, blah. The other thing I want to say about Durant, one final point, is he doesn't have a lot of wear and tear in that body. He's not a 94-foot player. He's never been really out. I'm glad to get him, but I think he's got a lot of legs left. So thank you, and I'll listen.
I mean, we'll see in terms of a lot of legs left. You know, I think when you look at his frame, remember years ago he had the foot injury. I mean, he has had sort of a history of foot, and ankle.
I know he weighs 13 pounds, but he's a huge guy. So you're right. When you start to talk about a seven-footer that starts to have the leg issues that he has, it's a fair concern, no question.
And he's not – like I've heard people have made the Dirk comparison. The thing about Dirk is Dirk got, like, burlier as he got older, and Dirk also operated a ton out of the post. What you can do as you get older, can Durant do that? I mean, is that a strength of his game?
No. No, it's not.
I would say this. I feel like I'm more comfortable with LeBron James late in his career being a true impact player, closer to what he was in his prime, than I am with Kevin Durant. I think he has three more years at this level, 34, 35, 36. And then I'm not saying he's going to fall off the map, but I think 37, 38, 39, expecting him to be the same player is really asking a lot, both, you know, physically in terms of his body holding up and also stylistically, just in terms of his style. I mean, I've heard people, again, make that Dirk comparison or say he's a jump shooter. Yeah, I guess you can, you know, just shoot over people. But you also have to be able to take people off the dribble to create some of that space and elevate to be able to hit. Like, he's not – if Kevin Durant evolves or morphs into basically just like a spot-up three-point shooter, if he's basically a super – charged version of like Sam Perkins back in the day. Is that really helping you at 37, 38 years old?
No, it's not. But I think that window for the first couple of years there where he's still playing at an elite level, the caller touched on it. Like, you may, again, I'm not taking anything away from the finals run that they had. Well deserved. I get all that. But you saw some of the deficiencies on the offensive end. A lot of that, by the way, Marcus Smart, that we just talked about at the end of those games.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of that changes when you bring in a guy like Kevin Durant, and all of a sudden, you're not putting so much on Jason Tatum's plate, and you also have a guy that you can say, like, hey, can you go get me a bucket?
Because, that's true.
Look, Jaylen Brown scores, but in terms of, like, all right, here's the ball, like, go to work, that's not his game. It's not. And so I think that totally changes the complexion offensively for the Boston Celtics. It's one of the reasons why I would make that deal. All right, 617-779-0985. See you guys lined up. There's also two open phone lines if you want to jump in and grab those. More of your phone calls coming up next on Gasper and Murray. It's Tim McCone in for Big Jim.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Live from Gillette Stadium. Down, Patriots! It's New England Patriots Training Camp 2022, presented by Safety Insurance. Also brought to you by United Construction and Win Waste Innovations on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
I've done that Valvoline read. I'm no exaggeration, Gasper. 10,000 times in my life, felt confident that I could get through without really looking at it while watching a Sean Kemp YouTube compilation.
That was my fault. I was distracting you with this.
It was an error on my part. That did not go well. 617-779-0985, the telephone number. Talking NBA with you, specifically this Kevin Durant potential deal with the Boston Celtics. Would you be willing to give up Jaylen Brown to bring in Kevin Durant? 617-779-0985. Let's go talk to Tim in Rhode Island. Tim, what's up?
How you doing, guys? I wouldn't make that trade. I think there's too much risk. Kevin Durant gets hurt. He's done in my book. I mean, who played well into their late 30s other than LeBron James? And Jaylen Brown gets hurt, and he's much less talented than Kevin Durant, but you get him back, and he's still a young guy. And Marcus Smart is too good defensively. Derek White was unbelievably inconsistent in the playoffs. His shot form is horrible, and bigger players run right through him. So in my mind, that's way too much to give up, way too much risk to get a superstar who's aging and, in my opinion, is injury prone.
All right, Tim. Well, you know, I certainly see the point. You know, I agree with the overall point on Jaylen Brown. Where we diverge is probably Marcus Smart a little bit. You know, I don't think the drop-off, and I don't think Ime Udoka thinks the drop-off is as great as you portrayed it as from Smart to White defensively. Clearly, Smart is the better defender. No one's disputing that. But White is a pretty good defensive guard. I also think, though, that when you look at it, you have to look at it sort of holistically in terms of, you know, what your depth is overall on the team. And I think you have some depth at that point guard position. And if you wanted to make this deal, I wouldn't let Smart sort of be the holdup in this deal. I still think your defense would be good because, to me, what made the defense elite was Jason Tatum taking a step defensively and then Al Horford, Robert Williams, and Grant Williams all being bigs who basically can switch out on smaller players 25 feet from the hoop and not get blown by. You know, that Robert Williams, 25 feet from the hoop, not only are guys not getting by him, if they do, he stops him at the rim. If they try and pull up, he swats their three. And just the other thing on Smart in the defense, I would ask some of the smarter files out there. And again, he's a great defensive player, deserving defensive player of the year. Yeah. But in terms of the impact, I think it is overrated and overstated at times. Did he prevent Giannis from running through you?
No.
Did he prevent Jimmy Butler from going off?
No.
Did he prevent Steph Curry, with the exception, I would say, of one game where he defended him really well, did he prevent Steph Curry from killing you in the finals?
Nope.
So then what ultimately is the value of that defense? It's valuable.
Right.
I don't dispute that, but it's not like you're talking about somebody who takes out the other team's best player for an entire series, because all those guys lit it up against the Celtics in the series.
Well, and again, it comes down to this. It's a superstar-driven league, right? And so those guys, you can have a great defender, a guy like a Giannis, a guy like a Steph Curry, and Jimmy Butler, I guess you put in that category too, are going to kind of get theirs, especially in the postseason, kind of regardless, I think, sometimes of who's defending them.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I do think there is some value to what Marcus Smart brings to the table. I just don't think that there is that significant of a drop-off from the guys that you either had on the roster in terms of Derek White or Brogdon that you're bringing in this year, where you go, oh, no, there's no way we can possibly replace it. And I think it's unfair to kind of say that he's the heart and soul of this team when the reality is it really is Tatum and Brown. And if it's not Tatum and Brown, then it's Tatum and Durant if you build around those two guys. But that's going to be kind of the engine that makes this thing go here. And maybe you could throw in Robert Williams. To your point, I would argue that probably Robert Williams had a much more impactful presence on the defensive end than Marcus Smart, despite the fact that Marcus Smart was Defensive Player of the Year. I think that's when that kind of unlocked a lot of things for the Celtics here moving forward. And so, yeah, I just Marcus Smart would not be the reason that I wouldn't make that deal. Here's my question, because we kind of talked about the two camps that Zach Lowe kind of laid out in terms of where you fall in terms of your evaluation of the Celtics, and that is one of two things. Either one, it's an ascending young team that's now two wins away from a championship, and you know you just need a little more seasoning, a couple pieces like a Brogdon and Gallinari, and you're right back there. Or you look at it and say, hey, yeah, that's a great finals run. I don't want to call it necessarily fluky, but again, Milwaukee didn't have Chris Middleton. The Heat completely banged up. And by the way, you were Jimmy Butler three away from going home in that game. You had to win three road games in that series, too. Things had to be completely dysfunctional in Brooklyn. I would imagine they'll probably stay that way. If you
Philadelphia's gotten better this offseason, though.
That's a good point.
Tyrese
well.
Maxey is an ascending player.
Yep, absolutely. So how do you kind of view the situation, whether it's kind of a fluke run and you really need to make some major additions, or do you think that they are closer to that team that is just it's right on the doorstep of that championship?
I think they're closer to the team on the doorstep. I do think it's not a fluke run, but you certainly had some luck. But here's my thing. I think the Celtics already addressed the fact that they can't just sit back and say, okay, we made the finals, we're the best team, we're good to go. They added a major piece in Malcolm Brogdon. Now look, he's not Kevin Durant, not even close. But he's a significant upgrade when you look at the fact you're now, what are your three best offensive players? It's Tatum, Brown, Malcolm Brogdon versus Tatum, Brown, Marcus Smart. That's a pretty big upgrade. So I don't think they've just rested on their laurels. I think they've already upgraded the team and addressed that camp of, hey, you can't just sit on the fact that you made the finals.
All right, let's sneak in a couple more calls here before we switch gears and go to Hub Headlines. Let's talk to Matt in Providence. Matt.
Hey, Tim. It's Matt Reed. How you doing?
Hey, what's going on, Matt?
Hey, not much, man. Yeah, no, I told you a caller. We used to work in Providence, and obviously I'm up here in Boston. I don't get this. I just do not get this for the life of me. I mean, I'm definitely in the camp that they are a young team ascending. And I remember in the finals, the games where Tatum didn't show up, who was the one that was leading the way? It was Jaylen Brown that was keeping this in the game. So I don't get this for the life of me. And also, you're betting the future on Kevin Durant, who we've already seen, you know, is injury-prone. That just seems ridiculous to me now, but that's kind of besides the point. With obviously this leaking, that the fact that they're looking at this, obviously, can they have a conversation behind the scenes and get everyone back on the same page? I mean, we all talked about how great the team chemistry was. Obviously, now there's this reporting that, you know, they were looking to deal Brown, so I think they might be kind of, you know, in trouble with that. So I don't know, man, but hope all well.
Oh, thanks for the call, Matt. NBC, NBC 10 alum there, Matt. Now doing big things in Boston.
Oh, that's
one of
cool.
The best. Yeah, absolutely.
I just had this thought, and I know we have to go to break, but I just want to throw it out there real quick. Here's the other thing: the Celtics have kind of been down this road before a little bit with Kyrie Irving, mm-hmm. I thought it was the right move at the time, where it's basically, you know, you ignore everything else and you take the talent. But wouldn't it be a little bit of a red flag for the Celtics, having dealt with the Kyrie Irving experience, that Kevin Durant is so dedicated to Kyrie and is kind of like a Kyrie acolyte? And he doesn't behave like Kyrie. That's not what I'm saying. But he clearly, like, listens to the guy, believes in him, and makes excuses for him. Wouldn't that be, like, a little bit of a red flag if you were the Celtics, given what they lived through with Kyrie?
Can I be honest with you right now? Because I'm very much team trade for Kevin Durant. You've really backed me into a corner here, because I am very anti-Kyrie Irving. So it's a fair point. It's a fair point, but I just ultimately, I'm so intoxicated by the talent that Kevin Durant brings to the team. Again, I mean, we talk about so often, like, superstars becoming available in the NBA recently, and it feels like every few months here, one shakes loose, whether it's James Harden, Anthony Davis, you go down the list. Man, I put Kevin Durant in a completely different category. Like, he's the elite of the elite, like a perennial MVP.
You're right.
Pencil him in for 30 plus. Like, that is different than, because we had a caller last night, I was on with Matt McCarthy, and he said, oh, well, you know what? Maybe you ride this out, you see what you have this year with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, and if it doesn't go well, let's say last year was a bit of a fluke, right? You get bounced in the second round by Milwaukee this year, or in five games. You realize this core isn't going to be good enough. Well, just go flip Jaylen Brown then for a guy like Bradley Beal and do that. I would say, number one, the Bradley Beal contract's disgusting now at this point.
Yeah, it's a big contract.
But the second thing is, like, Bradley Beal and Kevin Durant are not equals. Like,
no.
Those are two completely different things when you're talking about adding a player to your roster. Kevin Durant is a special, special, special talent versus just, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, a guy like Bradley Beal isn't a good player, but you can find all-stars. You can't find perennial MVPs like Kevin Durant. And guys like that don't become available on trade. It's very rare that a guy like this actually comes up the way that Kevin Durant has.
Yeah, you make a very strong case here. I know we need to take a break, but you make a really strong case. And I'll just say this. If the Celtics make the deal, I even though I wouldn't do it, I'm not going to be mad about it, and I'm not going to criticize it. I can totally understand where they would make the deal.
All right, 617-779-0985 is the telephone number. Going to step aside here, 90 seconds. Hub headlines. When we come back, I want to get into some Red Sox talk because an interesting trade deadline coming up for Boston. That's next after headlines.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.